337-8423. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can also write us letters. We are at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia, and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test-covid-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chauchage, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, November 11th, 2021. On tonight's show, a retro episode, some of my favorite recent interviews from the past year. My guests include Dean Patrick Fleming, director of Every Brilliant Thing.
The fact that depression can be normal, and in some ways sadness is normal, and that it's okay, and that in a way you're not there to beat it, but that you can acknowledge the feelings you're having no matter what they are, and that maybe it's a little bit of a nudge to also acknowledge the moment that something made you laugh in a day.
Director of Behavior, Emma Tibaldo.
It changed my world. It changed the way I look at my past. It really did make things concrete that were fluid for me. So I'm forever grateful to this play and to Dara for putting it forward and to having the courage to do it in the way that she's done it. She's done it her way.
And actress Amelia Sargeson.
My journey over the past 10 months bankrupts language. We've all been riding these really huge ups and downs.
The Siegel Center's Every Brilliant Thing continues its run until November 24th, so I wanted to replay my conversation with director Dean Patrick Fleming from last spring when the show was first put on, a collaboration between the Siegel and Hudson Village Theatre, where Dean is the artistic director. The original play, Every Brilliant Thing, first appeared at the Edinburgh Fringe, performed by British comic Johnny Donohoe, who basically co-wrote the show with a fellow Brit and a playwright named Duncan MacMillan. It's a deceptively simple premise, with the narrator on stage greeting audiences member as they enter the space. The lights actually never go dark. It only lasts 75 minutes. Our narrator can be any woman or man of any background, but the story is always the same, a 7-year-old child learning that his mom or her mom has depression. Their way of grappling with that harsh reality is to start listing everything they see as good and wonderful in the world, from hugs to ice cream to the color yellow. Montreal actor Danielle Brichoux was hired to bring the narrator to life in this incarnation. It has been performed all across Canada and all around the world with a plethora of different kinds of actors. Now, last spring, when I spoke with director Dean Patrick Fleming, we were in the midst of returning to theaters after a long break, and Dean was not only excited to be back at work in person, but he contended that Every Brilliant Thing was the perfect piece of theater to see back then. And I'd say the same thing about it now. It's ongoing until the 24th of November. This is my conversation with director Dean from last April. Welcome back to Upstage, Dean. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, Sarah. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. It's so nice to speak with you again.
Yeah, it's great to be here. It's great to talk with people about theater.
I know, right? It's been a long, hard, over a year now. Hard to imagine that it's clocking in already at 13 months.
I know. It's kind of wild. Time doesn't really mean much these days. It feels like everything, I don't know, everything feels both like it was 4 years ago and last week.
Well said. I'm going to hold on to that quote because I like that a lot. This is an interesting journey for a show like this. This production was originally going to not be at the Siegel Center, which, by the way, I'm reaching you in the studio space right now, and I can see you on Zoom, and it's exciting to see you sitting with all the seats. Like, there's a very real sense like theater is being made here.
Yeah, it's really, it's so lovely to be back in the theater and just knowing that we're so close to having people come and see the play. And it's exciting to be here. And I kind of have to remind myself to look around and appreciate it, because it's not something we've been able to participate in for so long. So even in little moments when COVID is frustrating me, I do tend to look up and see the lights on and see all the seats, and it's a lovely space to be in.
So let's talk about the circuitous route. I don't know if you would agree with that description, but the route that Every Brilliant Thing has taken.
Yeah, it's kind of wild, you know. So I was introduced to the show a number of years ago by a colleague out west, and just hearing him talk about the play made me really curious about it. And then soon after that, I read it and right away decided that I just wanted to do it. It's like nothing else I've ever personally worked on. So it was a really interesting challenge for me as a director, but also just a really such a beautiful, beautiful story and a beautiful way to tell it. And so so I programmed it for Hudson Village Theater, and it was supposed to go up in, October 2020.
That's wow. Right.
And obviously that whole season didn't happen. It was supposed to be the fourth play. We were going to have a full four plays in the year. We were pretty excited about expanding our season, and this was going to be the fourth play. And so it didn't happen. And then sometime around Christmas time, John Rondo and Lisa Rubin contacted me and asked if we would be interested in bringing it to the Siegel. And so we went back and forth a little bit, and it just became such a great idea. And this was, I guess, we were supposed to do it in February or March, and we actually did rehearse it, and we got shut down. And so now we've come back, and we'll be doing it in, coming up very soon.
Yeah.
Here at the Siegel. And then it will play out in Hudson this summer.
Come hell or high water.
Yeah. So it's going to be a really kind of a different way to see it out in Hudson, because we're going to be doing it in a big tent. So it's going to be really wild. I'm really excited. The play can work in just about any kind of a space. And it's really exciting for me as a director, and for Danny to be able to do it in two different spaces, two really different ways.
I'm curious to know, for the Siegel, when John and Lisa approached you, and it's important to note that the Siegel hasn't had a live show in over a year. They did do the Zabrina play in the fall with a live broadcast. It was streaming to people's homes back when cases were mounting again. That was seems ages ago, but it was just last fall. So when they approached you, you know, what was the idea between setting up this partnership and doing it in two different places? Because as I mentioned to you before we started recording, I haven't heard of a Hudson Village Theater Siegel Center partnership before. So why do this show in two different times, two different places?
I think, you know, my best answer would be because I think everybody needs to see this show right now. And that was our biggest reason for wanting to share it with the Siegel audience as well as the Hudson audience. It's a show that talks about acknowledging the darkness of the darkness of a person's life, while also really acknowledging the bright moments that we see every single day and the brilliant things we see every single day. And so I can say that I programmed it, you know, a couple of years ago. It is way more relevant right now. It is so needed right now. So that was the main reason that I was really excited about the idea of doing it in two different spaces. And the other thing I think, one thing I think I've learned over the last little while is partnerships are going to be really important moving forward. You know, we need to help each other out. We need to work with each other. I think that's not going to be just in the theater. That's everywhere now. You know, moving forward, the world has changed quite a bit. And so I feel like I'm really excited about this partnership. And it just made sense at the time.
You touched on the play, and I do want to get into that. I'm speaking with Dean Patrick Fleming, who is directing Every Brilliant Thing at the Siegel Center starting on May the 1st and eventually coming back, of course, to the Hudson Village Theater, where you're top boss. We have to mention that. Let's talk about Duncan Macmillan's play. It's a beautiful story. I first thought that it was from the perspective of a child, but it's actually an adult son looking back in the past, right?
Yeah, it is. So the play is about a man who, when he was 7 years old, his mother tried to commit suicide. And his response to that was to make her a list of all of the brilliant things in the world so that she would be happy. And now this man is telling the story of his life and how this list sort of became a huge part of his life and followed him through his life. That's the story.
I was interesting to note that the play itself, written by Duncan Macmillan with Johnny Donahoe, actually, at the beginning, they say that it could be a man or a woman, any kind of ethnicity, any kind of person. I think the original version specifically had a British man in the lead role. That's kind of interesting. Does that speak to the universality of the message?
Yeah, totally. I really do think anybody could be in this play. You have to just choose the right actor. And for me, I've known, you know, it's been done across the country a number of times, and it's been done by men, by women, people of color. What matters is that you believe the person fully, and that you, when the person comes on stage, you just need to like them right away. And so for me, when I was choosing who I wanted to work with on this, Danny became, he was just a perfect choice for me. We've worked together a number of times, but Danny just has that quality. And there's only a couple of actors that I know that have it, that as soon as they walk on stage, you're drawn to them, you believe them, and you're with them, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really important.
I have to agree with you on that. I'm a huge fan of his work. And a lot of his work, I was telling this to Lisa Rubin earlier today, actually, a lot of his work sticks in my mind. Like, I may not remember the exact play or what he was doing, but I feel like I have so many snatches of memories from seeing Danny on stage because he's so magnetic and so fully incarnates whatever role he's doing in the moment. So I haven't seen the show yet, but I say good casting choice.
Yeah, he's a lovely actor, and he's an incredible human being. And there's something about this play. Like, when I did approach Danny and I sent it to him, The first thing he said is, "Dean, I'm terrified. Like, I'm so scared of this place." And it took him a couple of days, and I said, "I know, and you should be, because it's a scary thing. You know, so like, the audience comes in, and the lights don't go down.
Right.
The guy just comes on and starts telling a story. So there's no fourth wall. There's no hiding. There's no character. It's a guy telling a story about his life, and it is quite bare, and it's really beautiful. And so it is scary for an actor. I think it's a really, really different type of play.
Do you know?
I don't think about it as a play. I actually think about it as an experience.
What do you know? What scared him specifically?
I think it's that, right? That you're looking straight into the audience's eyes the whole play. The house lights don't go down, so the audience is very much they're part of the play. Like, you know, it's like a TED talk. Mm-hmm. That's just so different for an actor. You know, there's just really nothing to hide behind in this play.
Not other actors. You're not off stage at any point. But it also speaks to its roots, right? It was originally an Edinburgh Fringe play.
Yeah. Yeah, they did it. They did it at the Fringe, and then it became what it is. And then it traveled to New York. It played in New York for 4 months. It's been done all over the world. And it's just... I think it's just one of those plays that the audience leaves thinking that they've experienced something really special, which hopefully they have.
Speaking with Dean Patrick Fleming, who is directing Every Brilliant Thing, coming to the Siegel in just a couple of days and eventually the Hudson Village Theatre. What are your audiences back in Hudson telling you? Are people excited to be under the big tent this coming summer? You were mentioning that's how you're going to be presenting shows.
Yeah, I think everybody in Hudson's just waiting. Our audiences are definitely waiting for something to come, waiting for us to do things. And I think the only thing that everybody's wanting something, but they are wanting it to be done safely. And so that's why we have to be careful about when and how we do things. You know, we have to care for, we have to care for our audiences. We have to care for the artists we're going to work with, but I know that when we're ready, people will be ready to come and see it. And I think, you know, by this summer, like, it's already starting. You know, we talked about this before we went on, but we're getting there, right? Some people have been vaccinated now, and more people are being vaccinated every day. So we're close.
Including yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I got it last Friday. So that was a pretty exciting moment. It's such a weird moment, you know, after everything we've been through.
The ages have been lowered gradually, and they're slowly opening it up more and more. Are people in the milieu at work right now, like, gradually getting theirs? Like, it's becoming a reality?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, like everybody else, all the artists are following the news pretty closely and are waiting their turn or going as soon as it is their turn. We work in an industry where we're really close with people all the time, right? It's the way we work. And so we need to be able to feel safe as we work.
One last thing I wanted to ask you about is, you were bringing up how Every Brilliant Thing has a lot of relevance to today, more than when you initially, you know, came across the show and thought, I want to do this eventually. What are you hoping that the audiences that are, you know, eventually at the Hudson Village Theatre, but this week at the Siegel Center, they're coming in, they've been staying home for the last 14 months. There's been a lot of anxiety, a lot of concerns, and they're coming in to see this show about what it's like to value everything in your day and to beat depression and to beat what's kind of going through your mind. What do you want them to leave with?
I think the one of the most beautiful things about this play is how it talks about the fact that depression can be normal, and in some ways sadness is normal, and that it's okay, and that in a way you're not there to beat it, but that you can acknowledge the feelings you're having no matter what they are, and that maybe it's a little bit of a nudge to also acknowledge the moment that something made you laugh in a day, or you looked over and you saw a color on a flower that was incredible. And I think sometimes those things are easy to ignore at the end of a hard day, or as we've gone through a hard year, it's really easy to miss the little things or to not give them the level of importance that maybe we can, not should, but can. And that there's a balance in life, right? So it's okay. It's okay to feel sad. And I'll tell you, the reason I think this play is so much more relevant now than when I programmed to do it in the first place is because we have been through such a hard time and such a sad time, and people who have never felt the level of sadness or the level of hardships that they've felt over the past year are not necessarily sure how to deal with that. And maybe they think it's not normal, but I think this play talks about how it is, and but that there's a great bright side to things too, and that they have to live in balance.
Can't wait to see the show. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time, Dean.
Thanks so much, Sarah. It was really great talking to you.
That was Dean Patrick Fleming, Artistic Director of Every Brilliant Thing at the Siegel Center. The show runs until November 24th. Visit siegelcenter.org or 514-739-7944. I'm your host, Sarah DeA. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca. Coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, an actress who used her downtime during the pandemic to start flexing her writing muscles. We're in a retro episode this week. We're visiting some stellar interviews from the year so far. Now, with the Montreal mayoral race finally over as of last weekend, and the coming return of Parliament later this month after the snap election this September, I wanted to revisit a show set in the world of Canadian politics. Behavior was actually staged at the Siegel as well, a reading from Playwrights Workshop Montreal of a newish work. Writer Dara Tidle introduces you to Mara, a young woman living out her dream to work in politics on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. But even as Mara tries to change the world for the better, she comes up against abuse of power repeatedly and has to find a way to make her voice and truth in a world that would rather she shut up. Emma Tibaldo is both director and dramaturge on the production. Emma spoke with me in March of this year. Welcome to Upstage, Emma. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for taking the time. So this is a very current play. I was noticing in the notes, Kelly Nestrick of the Globes called Behavior one of the smartest plays to respond to the Me Too movement. So this is kind of striking with the iron is hot. Can you tell me about Mara, the woman we meet in Behavior?
Dara wrote this play before the Me Too movement, or at least the first part of the play before the Me Too movement. So it was at a time when she was really outraged, well, obviously still is, about the fact that women are abused and that it remains silent. So she wrote this play, and Mara, who is the character of the play, is a professional working in Parliament as a staffer, and she's been conditioned over her life to accept certain abusive behavior, and it affects who she is in the world. So she's part of what the play is trying to do is trying to let us as an audience notice all the microaggressions that she goes through that make her who she is, or that contribute to her being who she is and moving through the world the way she does. And then as we watch her life unravel, her professional and personal life unravel, we hopefully understand that this is not something that she called upon herself, but something that has been put on her and that she has to work her way through, or find a way through. Hard to work your way through abuse, but find her way through. Yeah.
So Dara's putting the onus on her character. Why do you think she chose to do it that way? That you just said that Mara's the one who has to work her way through sexism and power imbalances.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that she has to work her way through that she has to work her way through the trauma of what's being done to her. So she has to come to the realization of what's happening to her. And then she has to take the power of changing that. Yeah. Yeah, and truthfully, the play really does look at what are the options for women once they come to a place where they understand the extent of the abuse and that there isn't a clear way for women to find justice. Right. Because they're not believed, or because the onus is on their story, or the system is set up so that there are non-disclosure clauses, so you can't talk about things, which, you know, is a fairly central part of this play as well. This idea of how does the non-disclosure clause silence women, because they're in desperate need for recompense. But in order to get that, they have to be silent. So it's looking at that as well.
I think the Harvey Weinstein allegations in particular, that was a recurring thing, that women had signed NDAs and were not able to talk, or they would face legal repercussions, which is so terrifying because you think you own your narrative and what happened to you, but actually, according to this dotted line, maybe you don't.
Yeah, and you don't, and they can put you through lawsuits and for you completely. So yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So interesting choice to have this on Parliament Hill. We, you know, the halls of power for Canadian politics. Politics has not been a world immune to people speaking out and talking about, you know, relationships behind the scene and being marginalized. We've heard about so many things in the last couple of years. Was this setting, a political setting, particularly intriguing to you? Did you kind of learn anything about, you know, kind of the power dynamics that exist in this particular environment?
Yeah, I think what's true is that power can breed abuse. You know, we know that, and watching it happen, even in the places where we think are the most progressive and forward-thinking, like socialist parties, or parties of the like, is eye-opening. We don't want to believe that, but it does, and it becomes about individual power within systems. And so, yeah, it can happen anywhere, to anyone, at any time. And the play makes that very clear, that no one is immune, and that you may not even recognize it, which I think is the most powerful part about this play, is that it does allow you, it gives you the time to look back on your own experiences and recognize them for what they were or what they are still in your body. For what that trauma, what the effect, what the residue of all of that is in terms of who you are and how you move around in the world. So, it does that brilliantly.
Speaking with Emma Tibaldo, director of a new play by Dara Title, relatively new play called Behavior, a production by Playwrights Workshop Montreal, coming up this weekend. You talked a little bit early on about what recourse you have and what options women have to kind of speak out. And oftentimes when a woman comes forward or someone comes forward and brings up allegations, things that were toxic, the power imbalances, there's a lot of like, well, why didn't you do this, or why wasn't this done? And it's so fascinating because it's like always 2020 looking back, and I feel like critics and people who wonder aloud about why wasn't this option followed instead, this would have been the right thing to do. They don't seem to put themselves in the mindset of, you know, if you were being traumatized or harassed or abused, you know, you might have trouble figuring out what the right path is to take. Is that a little bit of what Mara is navigating?
Absolutely, all the way through. And where she gets to once she makes those discoveries and owns them, is quite fascinating in the play. So the last, the third part of the play is post realization and just trying to move forward. So you get a sense, it's almost like real-time feeling through her experience, understanding it, getting to the place of recognition, and then what happens after. And the what happens after is set in her home with her grandmother. So it becomes sort of a look into where do we get our power, where do we get our strength, and where do we also get those
character traits that allow us either not to recognize things as abnormal. That's also part of it. So the play actually takes you through this huge journey of watching it happen, understanding why it's happening, then understanding where she gets to, and then after that, figuring out what do you do next, and what are the hurdles, and what are the compromises that you have to do, because the world, yes, still does not allow you to come out and say I was sexually abused, and for that to be enough.
This kind of rewriting that happens in the public discourse when someone brings forward, especially bombshell allegations against someone who's, you know, high up power-wise, this rewriting and this questioning, that must have really interested you as a intellectually, because you're also the dramaturg on this project, as well as the director, in terms of stories and how stories get questioned and choices get questioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think This play intrigued me from the get-go in terms of form. It's also written in a way that's unexpected. The first part of it are short, really intense scenes that get to the heart of the matter. Right. Then there's a huge monologue, and then it goes into a farce, and then there's a fairly physical epilogue. And just watching her move through the different kinds of theatrical expressions in order to get a message across, then looking at time as very elastic. It moves in a very elastic way. A day can take up, you know, a fair amount of space in the play, and then 9 months can take up a very small amount of space, so that you're constantly trying to battle of when you are in the play and when the character's in the play, because frankly, everything becomes one. Like abuse, if you're in it long enough, becomes all of it becomes one, all of it becomes part of the same thing. So work harassment, sexual assault, family dynamics and relationships all can become one thing in your mind, and frankly all stem from the same place, wanting to dominate someone. So yeah, watching her go through all this in her professional world, which, you know, we've seen tons of examples of, you know, we hope these are awesome human beings, they turn out not to be. And watching her deal with this on a personal level at home, watching her deal with it on a personal level with her husband, and then put into the mix a child, a newborn child that she is responsible for, and how that changes everything.
Okay.
As well. Yeah.
Speaking with Emma Tibaldo, who is the director and dramaturg for Behavior, coming this weekend. So what can we expect? This is going to be a reading. Are we seeing blocking as well for the piece?
No, it's absolutely a reading. Okay. It's a reading that is been thought through with digital. So there are, obviously, there will be digital elements. It's set up, I believe, in a very interesting way, in a way that will carry you through. But you know, the character in the center is the play. And Amelia Sargeson as Mara is extraordinary, and the other actors are, so incredible and present. And so it's all about getting the story out into the world right now. And I think, it's a reading, so it's set up as a reading. There's never any doubt where you are, so you're really paying attention to story. Done beautifully, I hope. I mean, I hope you all feel that way, but I do. So I think it's about, you know, having a quiet space in front of your computer.
I saw Amelia Sargeson actually tweet about rehearsing and getting ready, and she was so excited to be in such a strange year, right, where a lot of actors aren't performing as much as they'd like. She was super excited to be getting ready for this particular production. Are you seeing that energy across the board with your cast and crew?
Oh yeah, they're all amazing. Everyone is, you know, exceptional. And so from Aaron Shields to Victor Trellis, Felicia Schulman and Amelia Sargeson, incredible. And Potato Cakes Digital has, you know, just been with us all the way through creating.
That's your digital dramaturg collective, Potato Cakes. What is a digital dramaturg collective?
Well, they work on everything digital right now in terms of getting things to live stream or creating the design of the digital production. They are, you know, designers. They're both designers and they're both very interested in technology. So they have the skill set to understand how to make digital work for live stream, how to create a hybrid theatrical experience.
How to make it work on the computer.
How to make it work, yeah.
A bit of a kind of optimistic note this week as we learned about live theater and, like, I guess comedy and music returning. But I'm also thinking a lot about what we've learned over the past years. When I say we, I mean artists, what's been learned and picked up in skills in terms of creating visions for online and how to tell stories effectively to an audience, as you just said, sitting alone at home or with someone in front of the computer. Do you feel like you've learned a lot over the past year? And are you hoping to keep some of the stuff, for example, that Potato Cakes brings to the game, right? Hoping to keep that through for whenever we, you know, return to all being live?
Yeah, I think everything feeds into everything else, and accumulated experience and knowledge just makes everything move forward. I totally believe that. I don't think the future of theater is digital, but I think digital is a part of theater from here on in. And I think sharing platforms, I think being able to create versions of things that can be put over the internet so that more people can see it, more people can experience the stories, I think is amazing. So no, we won't let any of this go. Absolutely, we're going to build on it. It's part of what we've committed to. And Playwrights has been working really hard to be able to bring this information to the largest amount of artists possible. So yeah, it's important to us.
I think a lot of your audience is receptive to the story of a woman who's dealing with assault and abusive power, but not everyone necessarily is on the same page. Are you going to change minds with behavior?
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's what you hope every piece of theater does. It changed my world. It changed the way I look at my past. It really did make things concrete that were fluid for me. So I'm forever grateful to this play and to Dara for putting it forward and to having the, you know, the courage to do it in the way that she's done it. She's done it her way. And I think it's beautiful and brilliant and necessary and entertaining and wildly funny.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about it, Emma. I'll let you get back to work because I know you are gearing up for this Saturday. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time and for your interest.
That was Emma Tibaldo, director and dramaturge of Behavior. The show was performed at the Siegel last spring. It was live streamed and it was a production of Playwrights Workshop Montreal. You can find out more at playwrights.ca. One of the performers was actress Amelia Sargeson, who you will hear from in just a moment. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. It's a retro episode for Thursday, November 11th, revisiting some stellar interviews from the year so far. So I just featured my chat with Emma Tibaldo, director and dramaturge of the show Behavior, and actress Amelia Sargeson performed the role of political aide Mara alongside Victor Andres Trellis Turgeon as her boyfriend Evan, Aaron Shields as Jordan, and Felicia Schulman in several accompanying roles. Now, that show was live streamed last March, but I had actually spoken with Amelia at the start of the new year. Amelia is from Montreal, but has studied and worked in Toronto for many years. She has been back to perform at the Centaur recently in both The 39 Steps and more recently as Eve in Aaron Shields' Paradise Lost. shortly before the pandemic started, actually. Amelia will return next week to the Centaur in a brand new show from improv queen Rebecca Northern. Rebecca last brought her show Blind Date to the Centaur. This is an incredible show where she plays a character, kind of like a clown, who goes on a first date with somebody in the audience, and that audience member is on stage for the whole show as they progress through their relationship. But this time, Rebecca is back at the Centaur, and she's behind the scenes as director and writer of a new show called All I Want for Christmas. It is a pandemic play written last season by Rebecca, and it is set in Santa's mailroom. Amelia returns as an elf named Ginger. Having failed at several other jobs in the North Pole, Ginger is starting her first day in the mailroom when a mysterious package arrives. My friend Jim Burke at the Gazette teases in a preview piece this week that the show promises to be a charming elfin comedy, just the thing we need. It starts next week, November 19th, and runs until December 5th at the Centaur. But in the meantime, let's hear from Amelia, who took the slowdown of the pandemic as an opportunity to start writing. She presented her new solo work, For Shame, about a Celtic nun named Cecilia at the Centaur as part of the Catalyst offshoot of Wildside. This is our conversation from last January. Amelia, you, I guess this is a privilege of sorts. You're one of the last performers we saw on stage before things kind of halted, right, with Paradise Lost in the months before the pandemic started. That was such a fun production. You were playing Eve. What was it like to come off of that? And it was huge, right? Like, how many people were on stage? What was it like to come off of doing a big work like that at the Centaur?
My whole journey with that play was and has been, and I think will forever be, one of the most profound and exhilarating creative experiences of my life. And what was really magical for me about the Centaur production was, you know, not only that I got to reprise what I had done at Stratford and, you know, go deeper, especially in my relationship with Adam, who was immortalized by my beloved friend, Qasim Khan, but that I got to bring it home and share it with a home audience and share it with some local artists who were stepping into the roles of some of the older cast. So that was just, the play itself just is so huge, right? Like, we go all across the cosmos, and the journey internally mirrored that for me.
So coming off working on a big production like Paradise Lost, what's your reality been like since, I guess not since March, but these past few months? Like, have projects been put on hold? Have you been doing other things at the same time? I know everyone has got some, have all been doing different projects to keep busy and to keep working.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can say that it's been significantly more quiet. But I don't know, I was sort of thinking about how nature abhors a vacuum, and apparently so does Amelia. So I've found all kinds of other ways to fill the emptiness that opened when basically a year's worth of contracts evaporated. And what's been really joyful and what I'm so grateful for is that I've actually just been able to be a little bit more intentional and conscious about how I fill said vacuum, because I'm not just sort of blindly on the hamster wheel of chasing the next acting gig. So I've been able to do a lot more of my own writing, and I've always loved writing. I shouldn't say that. I've always been drawn to writing. I would say that I've always had a pretty fraught relationship with writing. But for me, at this moment, something sort of aligned, and it became the only way that I could sort of grapple with the chaos was through the written word. So I started a little creative accountability group this summer with local playwright Alex Haber, and we would just meet every week on Zoom. And what was, you know, the one thing that has opened up is the ability to work with friends and colleagues across the country. So that was really exciting. We even had a friend of mine joining us from Detroit. So, you know, we started there, each of us sort of watering these little seedlings of ideas, and it's just been kind of wild to see how my own piece has grown and how some of the other pieces from that creative accountability group have also grown. So I've been doing, you know, that kind of thing, like more self-started projects.
Which is, it's just a such a pivot, right, from being, as you were saying, you know, talking about contracts and being assigned up for different things where you're counting on someone else to kind of push your creative process forward because it's all teamwork, right? And in writing, it's so individual. How did you come to be in an accountability group? This is really interesting.
Well, I suppose that one of my creative role models and mentors was the springboard for the idea. Her name is Haley McGee, and she was actually in fourth year at Ryerson Theatre School, and I was in first year, so she's someone to whom I've always looked up. And she's now based in London, England, where she's a writer-performer. So she mostly does her own work and performs her own work. So she started right at the beginning of all of this, a 14-day creative quarantine challenge.
Wow.
Which I did with great relish and learned after the fact that Alex Tabor had also been doing it simultaneously to me. So then we thought, well, you know, that was just so great to be able to check in with, you know, this cohort of international artists. We should do something like that for ourselves to, you know, advance these projects, to push them to the next level. So it was just something that we talked about on a socially distant walk one afternoon, and then it came to pass. And we didn't want to give it too much structure because I think everyone has just been metabolizing so much over the past little while that you don't want to do something that's burdensome or that's going to feel like extra work, but rather something that's just going to buoy people up and ignite the creativity. So we just decided that every week we'd sort of pass the baton to a different person in the group to come up with some creative tips and insights. And it was such a pleasure for me to see what, you know, ideas were percolating in my friends and colleagues. And I amassed it all into this big Word document at the end so that we sort of have that as this inspo Bible if you're ever just sitting there ready to gouge your eyes out in front of the computer and not having any ideas. So, you know, it's just in the extra space, I feel like there has been some new birds.
I'm speaking with Amelia Sargeson, who is going to be part of Catalyst at Centaur coming up very shortly. And we're just talking about the writing process and how to keep track of it. I just was really curious about the accountability thing because I know how difficult it can be, like from a personal perspective as well, to keep on yourself, to keep going, especially in this weird time where it seems like what's going on in the news and the wider world is so strange. Either you want to look away or you can't stop looking away. So having this kind of support must be just totally invaluable. And you're probably getting a ton of terrific feedback as well on works in progress. So pivoting, let's talk about the work you're going to be talking about with Rose as part of Catalyst. It's called For Shame. Is this something you've been working on for the last, like for something you've been thinking about for a long time, or is it a more recent development?
Well, I would say that the prompt for this actually came this summer when Ida Holmes, the artistic director of Centaur, put out a call for this particle project of outdoor performances. And she was asking for pieces on the theme of unpacking the self, unpacking the moment, you know, really any iteration that your imagination could drum up of unpacking. And something about it just set something off inside of me. And so I would say a fit of writing produced this little baby awkward draft that I submitted to the Portico project, and then it was unsuccessful. I did not get into the Portico Festival, But what Edith said was, well, we want to launch this thing in January, and, you know, we think that your material might be better suited to an indoor context, i.e. not
outdoors.
Centaur. And of course, she was absolutely right about that, because as the title might suggest, it's actually a very confessional, intimate piece. So I was grateful for her better judgment there, prevailing and sort of shepherding me in the right direction with the tone and quality of this. And then the most attractive part about this offer from her was that Centaur would provide some dramaturgical support. So talk about accountability. Now I have it from, you know, an institution that I have admired from my girlhood. And then when Rose stepped into the picture, you know, I just was so delighted, because I think she has such a delicate and wild imagination, and I knew that she would be a beautiful midwife and steward, and so she is and continues to be. So that just really motivated me to say, okay, it's maybe not as dumb and awkward an idea as I thought, and keep going and keep diving. And it's interesting, you know, to sort of circle back to your actual question, which was, is it new or old? I'm finding that it's both things, really, because while the prompt was relatively new, I'm preoccupied creatively with many of the same themes, and so those have been, I've been musing on them and kind of hovering around them for my whole life, I would say, and they're finding expression in this piece and through this character, Sister Katrina.
Tell me about Sister Katrina.
Sister Katrina, she's a Celtic nun, and if that combination of words sounds weird, I promise you there's a reason for it.
Okay.
And she's in a very fraught moment in her life when she is moving back to her hometown of Montreal and wrestling with all of the mistakes she's made, and wondering in a really immediate and visceral way if it's possible for her to forgive herself.
Okay, so something from the past that she's wrestling with. Is the theme of coming back to Montreal, is that pulled from your own life? Because you grew up here and you've been away for some time for work. Is that a parallel?
You bet.
Okay.
You bet, yeah. And it's just, it's also like, I feel like the world is sort of in this collective moment of suspension, you know, where it's this liminal space where we're looking back and we're reckoning with everything that has preceded us and everything that we've done, and we're waiting to go forward into, I think, what so many people hope and are working actively to build is a better future. And there's something about moving, and especially moving to your hometown, to your place of birth, that reflects that sort of boomerang effect and that suspension effect, and this idea of having to really look at where you are. When you're at the threshold, you have to, you're so aware that you're on the threshold. So, yeah, I would say it for sure. It's just plucked from my own life.
So you'll be able to discuss Sister Katrina. You'll be discussing her and the show For Shame as part of Catalyst at Centaur. So is this kind of strange? Because not only is the work going to involve a reading, but then you have to talk about it as well. And I don't know how you feel about having to talk about, you know, talking about acting maybe is one thing, but maybe writing is a bit, it's harder sometimes. Is that something, what are you more nervous about, the reading or the Q&A?
Oh, boy. I mean, I think you're bang on that writing in some ways is an even more vulnerable enterprise. And then to be performing your own writing is this kind of bizarre form of masochism. But, you know, Haley, my mentor, talks about running towards what feels good in the material. And I really tried to keep that in mind. And I'm also just trying to approach this work in progress showcase as a lab, you know, where I'm in there experimenting, and, you know, a vital part of the experiment is the people who may or may not be watching, or no, who may be watching, hopefully. But I think that probably talking about it afterwards, because, you know, sometimes in these moments too, like, even though you're, unfortunately, when you're doing these live streams, you're divorced from that sort of palpable feeling of the audience being there. I still have experience in, when I've done these, that it is live, and that I do get that adrenaline and those nerves. And so then just coming down from that to sort of immediately be able to speak about it and put a sentence together, I think it'll be wild. Like, we'll see, you know. I'm just so grateful for the opportunity. And one of the things that I've always been searching for is more agency creatively and professionally. And when you're pivoting from being an interpretive artist to writing your own work, you get to lean into that, and it's so satisfying.
So one final question for you, Amelia. This is obviously a work in progress. We're going to hear a little bit more about it coming up at Catalyst. And what would be the ideal, not finale, but where would you love to see the play end up? What format? What stage? What's the big dream?
Well, I think the fun of doing a solo show is that it's really portable. So, you know, obviously I would love for it to receive a full production at Centaur one day, but I also would love to take it to the Solo Show Festival in New York City, or, you know, to the Edinburgh Fringe, I'm sure everyone has this, like, hunger to travel, and so part of what keeps me afloat is fantasizing about doing this show on the international circuit, but that's a long way away. I think just see first if it's going to resonate with other people. That's always the big question. You know, as you pointed out, writing is so solitary, and whereas rehearsing a play is this communal event where you sort of immediately can test whether anything you're trying is effective, and you immediately get feedback. You can see it right in your scene partner's eyes if what you're doing is working or not. Whereas, you know, with the long hours writing, I don't know, like, is this going to echo for anyone else? So that's the first tentative little step that I will be taking at the end of the month.
Can't wait to see it, Amelia. And thank you so much for coming on to talk about For Shame and for giving some of your time to Upstage. It's been really fun to check in with you, and I hope we'll be hearing from you again sometime soon.
Thank you so much, Sarah, and for giving a platform to local artists. It's really amazing.
That was Montreal actress and writer Amelia Sargeson on her developing work, For Shame. She spoke last January to me about presenting that work at the Centaur, and Amelia herself returns to the Centaur stage this coming week in All I Want for Christmas, a new comedy from Rebecca Northern. And I hope to bring you an interview with Rebecca next week as well, so stay tuned for Thursday, November the 18th. For tickets and information for All I Want for Christmas, you can reach out to centaurtheater.com or call 514-288-3161. Tickets are between $38 to $67. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. It's been a retro episode, but we'll have more fresh stories for you next week. This evening, you heard Dean Patrick Fleming, director of Every Brilliant Thing, director of Behavior, Emma Tibaldo, and actor Amelia Sargeson. A big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under the archives. A very big thank you to Jack Solar, our spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. And a big thank you to you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and ckut.ca. Have fun, stay safe. Up next is Grey Matters.
Yeah. This fall, one of North America's foremost documentary film festivals will take place.
Montreal International Documentary Festival.
ADM.
A 24th edition that's more socially engaged and unifying than ever.
The program includes this year's 100 best documentaries.
Screening from November 10th to the 21st in Montreal theaters.
Also available online from November 14th to the 25th all across Canada.
Come to the Cinémathèque Québécoise, where all stories meet.
Discover the complete program at ridm.ca.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Cinema Politica is thrilled to announce a special screening of the program Queer for Palestine on November 15 at 7 p.m. at La Sala Rossa. From intimate portrayal to experimental cinema, this program of queer shorts from Palestine and Lebanon examines the intersection of gender and sexual identity with the Palestinian liberation struggle. Co-curated with programmers from Regard Palestinien and co-presented with the Feminist Media Studio and the Palestinian Youth Movement, the event is part of Queer Cinema for Palestine, the first ever 10-day film festival celebrating global queer realities and standing in solidarity with Palestinians. The screening at La Sala Rossa will be followed by a discussion led by the Palestinian Youth Movement. All films will be available to stream online between November 15 and November 20th through queercinemaforpalestine.org. We hope to see you there.
Good evening and welcome to the November 11th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show we have a lecture that was recorded in the early 2000s, 2004. It's a lecture by Chalmers Johnson. He's a distinguished political scientist and was professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Blowback, Sorrows of Empire,